All right. Well, back to business here. I actually have something I have to fucking read. Jesus. Just the intro to our show that we've done 70 fucking six times that I now have to fucking read. No big deal.
Can you imagine getting arrested for fornication? I smoked Jack Harrer Bud out of double barreled Jack Harrer bowl with Jack Harrer.
This is all still from one joint he had.
Holy fucking science. Welcome back, everybody. Episode 75, Saturdays with Chicken Duck. Joining me this week, Jeffrey Loper.
Hey, hey.
As always, Casey Shear.
Hi.
Just take your time. In the studio today, we have a special guest. Our guest is the Pennsylvania... Well, it's a, I guess there's, you're probably not the Pennsylvania hemp historian. I guess you could be.
No, I'm the Pennsylvania
the
hemp
historian.
Right, there are no others.
That's fucking awesome.
That's right.
So, our guest today is the Pennsylvania hemp historian. He spent thousands of hours researching the historic Pennsylvania hemp industry. Since 1997, he's been teaching farmers, farm organizations, historical societies, community groups, the media, legislators, and just the general public about hemp. He is the author of Hempstone Heritage and the founder of the Keystone Cannabis Coalition. Ladies and gentlemen, Les Stark.
Hey, how you doing?
Nice to have you, bud.
It's good to be here.
And today you brought a friend.
This is my fiance, Erica McBride. She's the secretary treasurer of KCC. And also she's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Hemp Industry Council, of which I'm a board member. And she's also the executive director of the National Hemp Association, too. So she's got a lot of irons
you
in the fire.
You folks are busy.
Yeah.
I go to work, and I come home, and I want to take a nap. You guys do all that shit, too?
And that's not even all of it, too. She's also on a team going for a dispensary license, and that takes a lot of
I'd
work.
I'd imagine that's getting awfully exciting these days. There's probably a lot of that going on. Yeah.
Exciting's a word for it.
There's so much work involved. And, yeah. In fact... just to come over here, she had to interrupt. She was doing the filling out the paperwork that has to be done within a week, right?
Thursday's the deadline.
Yeah, Thursday. So it was a little bit to get her away from it, and then it's pouring out, raining outside.
Beautiful
yeah.
day out.
Yeah.
Thursday's the deadline for what, again?
To get the medical cannabis dispensary permit application in.
Oh, really?
And the grower. Yeah. Yeah, it's the deadline for the grower processor and the dispensary applications for phase two.
So you guys are going to open your own dispensary, or is that what it is? Or
I'm helping a group that's going for a dispensary license. So, yeah, if we win, we'll be opening one in Berks County.
Nice.
That's exciting.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm not a part of the team. Erica, the reason why she's the secretary treasurer of KCC, which there would be no KCC without her. I had the idea, I want to put together this organization, but without her skills behind the scenes, it just wouldn't have happened. So, I'm not really part of the business side. I concentrate purely on activism and try to develop the strategy and the vision for how we're going to approach this and how we're going to change the laws of Pennsylvania. End cannabis prohibition once and for all and relegate it to the ash heap of history.
What got you involved with the whole marijuana and hemp?
It's basically an act of revenge. I was in the Marines. I was a tank crewman, and I was in from 84 to 87. I got out, and, part of Marine culture is alcohol. So we drank oceans of alcohol and went to some of the wildest places on earth where just like mass parties all over the place. And I got out of the Marines I drank heavily for about 5 years after I got out. And, my mom said to me one time, she's like, why do you drink so much? So I don't know. Doesn't everybody drink? Cause in my world, everybody drank. So, I had been around weed so many times, and I was always like, no thanks, no thanks, no thanks. No thanks. I don't know why.
Because maybe it was illegal? Or
well, I was a wrestler in high school, and, I was, like, my senior year, I was 22-4-1. I had, like, 15 pins, won sectionals and all that stuff. And, you know, the stereotype was that
Smoke.
Yeah.
You're not smoking if you're running that. You're running your balls off during practice and shit.
Yeah, if you smoke, it's supposed to make you lazy. I thought I would lose my competitive edge and all that stuff. Then I went in the Marines, and, we had piss tests in the Marines. I came in right in the era of the Ronald Reagan era. Like, guys that were in a couple years before me said they used to smoke and blow the smoke out the barracks windows. But when I was in, it was a different time. So anyway.
Thanks a lot, Nancy Reagan.
No shit. So, and Reagan, too. Reagan was a big liar, about that stuff. He did some good things. I mean, when I was in the Marines, I was such a Ronald Reagan Republican back then that I didn't even know there was another side. It wasn't until after I got out before I started to listen and hear the arguments from the other side. And then I could, right.
Man. Especially,
You're
a Marine in the fucking Marines. I'd imagine you're kind of stuck with being a Republican.
Well, you don't care as much as the whole thing.
We didn't pay attention a lot, but one thing we knew, like when I was in tank school, he promised us a pay raise. So we were running in the morning formation at like 4:30 in the morning, and the captain announced that Reagan was reelected in a landslide, and we just whooped up a big, huge cheer. And sure enough, within weeks, we had that pay raise, and it was enough that you could notice it. I mean, back in those days, basically, military wages are basically poverty wages. But on the other hand, you don't have the expenses either, and you're young, and to you, it seems like a lot. So anyway, that's another story. But I got out of the Marines. I drank heavy for about 5 years, and I tried it a few times, but usually I was so drunk I didn't notice if I got high anyway.
Sure. You forgot the fucking evening anyway.
There was this time where, we were at the Edgewater Bar in Ephrata, which doesn't exist anymore, but, our friends, they used to do this code. They'd put their hand on their temple like this, and they'd be like, hey, you want to get some fresh air?
T.O.T.
Yeah, so... So I went out to get some of the fresh air, and it was the first time in my life that the high really kicked in, and I felt it. Went back in the Edgewater, and my cousin goes over to the jukebox, puts a quarter in, and puts on Jim Morrison, The Doors, and next thing I know, here, this is the end. Dude. And I was just like transfixed. I was like back in Nam, which, by the way, Nam was a bad war when you start having Nam flashbacks and you weren't even there. Anyway, so... I remember I felt like my spirit was detached from my body and floating behind me, just attached by a mere spiritual thread hanging in there to my head. And I was telling my cousin, I said, close your eyes and you can feel your spirit. He was like, knock it off, man, knock it off. Sitting there at the bar, So what I noticed is the more that I smoked weed, the less I had a desire to drink. And over the next several months, I thought, wow, I really like this cannabis thing. And we didn't call it cannabis back in those days. That's just this more politically correct term that we all kind of agreed to call it lately. Back then, it was weed.
Yeah.
It was pot, herb, whatever you wanted to call it.
Purple sticky pot.
Grass is kind of like...
Gotta let the old white hairs get serious. Call it cannabis.
Anyway, I started to finally relax. It took me 5 or 6 years, 5 years after I got out of the Marines, just to relax. My friends were always like, why don't you just relax? So weed helped me relax, and I started reading these books. I read a book about Gandhi, and then I read the complete works of Martin Luther King. And I read a book about the Dalai Lama. And I started reading a whole bunch of philosophical books, a lot of books about peace. And I started to really adopt the exact opposite of what my Marine persona was. And I actually sort of became like, I guess you would say, a hippie on a spiritual path. I started meditating, and I used to put incense and sit there and meditate. I read books like Be Here Now by Ram Dass and a whole bunch of stuff, actually. And I started to relax, and I decided I'm going to save my money, and I'm going to go to India. I got this book, Lonely Planet Guide, to how you could live in India. I was going to wander around India, learn how to play the sitar.
A lot of fucking people in India, bro.
I know. I was going to wander around India with the sitar and learn how to play it and get high and meditate. And
What kind of weed?
Well, just you know.
Used to lay down and take a nap.
You know, so... So I got about $1,000 saved up, and I was, you know, really studying. I was getting my plan. I couldn't wait to go to India. And, you know, one of my friends calls me up, who one of the guys who I got weed from, which I got it from several people. I'm from Ephrata. Like I said, it's not hard to find there. Never was. So my friend called. He comes over to our place, my apartment. My cousin was there, and he had half a joint. And he said, hey, this is the last I can get for a while. And so he smoked it with us. We got really baked. My cousin and I both play guitar, so we got our guitars out. We were playing for him, and he's like, oh, this is so cool. He's like, I got the front row seat. And anyway, before he left, he asked me if I could get him some. And I said, no. I said, you know, I don't get it. He's like, oh, come on. I thought we were friends. Look at all the times I got it for you. And I said, well, I know, Mike, but I don't get it for anybody. Because once you get it, you know, you think you don't want to be a dealer, but you get it for somebody. And then next thing you know, hey, can you get me some more? Get me, you know, and then he tells his friends, next thing you know, you are a dealer. So I basically said no. So he left. He called me up a couple days later and said, hey, man, did you get that stuff you said you were going to get me? And I said, no, I said that I wasn't going to get it for you.
So this guy's a narc.
Yeah.
Well, wasn't a very good drug dealer.
You know, I said no. So he called me back again a couple days later, and I said, Mike, I told you I'm not getting it for you. He's like, oh, come on. So by this time, I was thinking, you know what? I have to go get myself some anyway. So what the heck? So I figured I'd get him a half ounce. So when he came to get it, he said, hey, we'll be right over. He's on the phone. And I told him, I said, what do you mean we? I said, just you come over. He's like, no, this guy's cool. This guy, I was getting it from.
Telling me a bad story right now. Yeah.
So they came in my place. And basically, I knew something was up when I went to hand the weed to my friend. And instead, the other guy took it. I was like, wait a second, you know. And he left. And after that, we started hearing rumors going around all over town that there was going to be this big drug bust in Ephrata. And one of my friends had a friend who lived with a cop. And he claimed that he saw a list of over 80 people that were going to be arrested. And my name was on that list. And I started thinking, man. No wonder that was shady. I said, I bet. I'm one of them. I'm going to be one of the ones that go down. So week after week after week went by, and I started to think, I was just paranoid. That's nothing. And so anyway, after...
Now, did you completely stop smoking because in that time?
Oh, of course not. No. But I never stopped smoking, and I never will either. So anyway, I just forgot about it. Went to work one day, and they came and got me at work and arrested me and handcuffed me in front of all my coworkers. And I worked at the Ephrata Review, newspaper right in downtown. We printed the Ephrata Review, but we also printed a whole bunch of other newspapers, Lititz Record and college papers, all kinds of stuff. So anyway, next thing you know, I'm in jail. But this big drug bust that we had heard rumors of, 80-some people going down, it turned down to, it was four people. And one of the other guys was in the exact same position as me. Wasn't a dealer, just got talked into selling a half ounce. And the other two people were people with like really small amounts, selling an ounce or two or something like that. So, you know, in Ephrata, out of all the people they could get for weed too, I mean, half the town smokes. It's always been a smoking town. And so anyway, I had to, you know, next thing I know, I'm in the Lakes County Prison. And I called my mom, and she's like, well, you're screwed. She said, I told you, if you ever get in trouble, don't call me. I said, oh, come on, Mom, you got to help me. And I had like $1,000 in the bank. So I told her, I said,
India money.
Yeah, my money from India. So Fuck. So I said, you know, if you pay my bail, I'll pay you back. And she wasn't going to do it. And then she did it. And it was Friday night, Friday evening. If it would have been like a few more minutes later, I'd have spent the whole weekend. When I heard that over the intercom, said, Les Stark, get your stuff. You're getting out of here. Oh, it was such a relief. Man, oh, man, oh, man, oh, man. Because I tell you, when you go to jail, you feel like about as small as a human being.
Been there.
Yeah, you know, right? Yeah. Yep. It just feels like you've just been stripped. You're nothing.
And how long were you in for?
I was just a day.
I was in for less than 24 hours. Yeah, and I had the same feeling. I never, ever want to experience that again.
It's
and what year did this happen?
1993.
Okay.
This was April of 1993. I was arrested. And I was shocked because at that time in Ephrata, it seemed like practically legal. It seemed like nobody really cared about it because,
Reagan still cared about it. War on drugs. Was that at the height?
Well, 93, that's after the Reagan era.
But the war on drugs.
That was really, really kicking off.
80s, 90s,
Our fucking education.
Yeah.
Brought up around the fucking devil weed.
Right, which there's been a lot of like research done that where it had actually
complete nonsense.
It had a negative effect on the whole thing.
Right.
So, yeah. Let me look at you. Yeah. Pure product.
Well,
a failure.
Prank call.
So I had to wait 9 months before I went to trial. And this whole time, I had to go back to work. And I worked at the Ephrata Review. I had to help print the newspaper with thousands of copies of me on the front page rolling off in front of me.
Oh,
and help get that out, to dish that scoop out to the town. I had to face everybody. I had to go back to my, my mom and, you know, just everybody I worked with and stuff. And it, back then, it was sort of a disgrace to be arrested for weed. And
well, at least they let you keep your job.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's true. He said he had to because, you know, I wasn't pronounced guilty yet, you know. So.
Okay.
But in his mind, I was guilty. One of my bosses that worked upstairs. So anyway, it comes down to it, and they tried to get me to say, you know, if you tell who got it for you and all that stuff, and I'm like, I'm not going to tell who got me a half ounce. What the hell? So the night before, they called me and made a deal. They said, if you plead guilty, they'll give you 6 months probation, and you have to go to drug and alcohol rehab. And they said, but if you plead not guilty and you fight it and you lose, we're pushing for 3 to 6 months jail time. So I had to decide, and I talked it over with some people. I talked with my mom. She said, well, you have to plead guilty. She said, you did what they're charging you with, delivery of a half ounce. You did it.
Technically, you did it.
You did it.
So, yeah.
So you have to plead guilty. And, so I asked a couple other people, and they were like, well, it seems to me that's the best course of action. And right before we were getting ready to go into the courtroom, my lawyer said to me, we got to have a decision. What's it going to be? And I looked at my girlfriend at the time, and she said, if you fight this and you lose, I will not understand. And I looked at my brother. He said, let's fight it. I said, all right, we're going for it. So we went in, and we basically proved that it was entrapment. And it wasn't just a clever defense tactic. It was true. It was entrapment. They entrapped me. They made appeals to my friendship, all that stuff, to get me to do something that I didn't want to do. But that little victory cost me over $5,000. And back in those days, I was making $180 a week, take home. And, you know, I was barely making it anyway. I was living like a pauper so I could save money to go to India.
Lawyer costs? Or
what lawyer cost, and I think I beat the delivery charge, but I couldn't say I at least didn't have it, so I had to pay like a $450 fine for that, and I think there was court costs, but then the legal fees and the bail I had to pay and all that stuff. So it was like over $5,000, and to be honest with you, I don't even think I actually
over a fucking paid. Half an ounce.
Yeah, I think I still.
It was
owe
a
my
different
lawyer.
Time then, though. I mean, nowadays there's more people who would be like, "That's ridiculous."
You'd still get fucked right now.
I know, but I'm
you would
saying
get fucked right.
But
now.
I'm saying, like, when you're talking about how like it was so embarrassing and like with your coworkers and the
yeah,
town, everybody
right.
like looking down on you. Whatever. Nowadays. More people would be behind
you'd
be like, that's
more
ridiculous.
People.
That's
your
true.
Defense. You
yeah.
Right.
So
I know a guy.
Here's the kicker. Yeah. Here's the kicker. A couple years later, we found out that the chief of police for Ephrata Borough, his name was Tim Burkholder, and Tim Burkholder was contracting effort of borough cops out to the Lancaster County Drug Task Force to do these huge investigations that were never really going on. So he was skimming all this overtime money, really sending some people out for low-hanging fruit like people like me, and really letting this whole thing flourish. Now, who knows how deep the corruption goes in the good old boy network? They were probably all in on it. And stuff like that. I mean, the guy who busted me, my brother confronted him one time, flipped out on him, and the guy said, "It's deeper than you'll ever know." I think they targeted me because I got out of the Marines in 1987. My first taste of activism was when the KKK came to Ephrata. And I organized an anti-KKK rally. And after that, I was sort of known as a guy who stands up, for racial justice and equality and against the Klan. And I think the good old boy network wanted me. So anyway, he
probably doesn't jive too well with the good old boys network.
Well, anyway, so it came down to it. They proved that Tim Burkholder, the chief of police of Ephrata, stole at least $100,000. And that's only what they can prove. And they believe that he stole hundreds of thousands of dollars more that they can't prove. So when we talk about the corruption of the drug war, I'm not talking about Panama, Colombia, Venezuela, you know, some foreign exotic locale. I'm talking about Ephrata, where I come from, you know. And so after I got busted too, I read this book by Jack Herer called The Emperor Wears No Clothes. And it's a fascinating book. I hope everybody knows it. Jack Herer, they call him the Emperor of Hemp. He's basically the godfather. I met Jack Herer. I smoked Jack Herer bud out of double-barreled Jack Herer bowl with Jack Herer. So I read Jack Herer's book, and he said that wherever there are major hemp-growing regions in the world and in America, there were towns named after hemp. And he mentioned Hempfield Township in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and it was like a light bulb went on over my head that I thought, but part of me was thinking, wait a second, though. This is a pretty fantastic story.
I work there.
Yeah. So, you know, I thought, what, we made our clothes out of marijuana? It used to be legal.
Well, there's
fucking
tobacco everywhere. I figured there's...
Well, the rise of the tobacco industry seems to be kind of commensurate with the decline of the hemp industry. And that was like the new cash crop that replaced it. And but that's what I was just so fascinated. That's what got me into it. And the reason I stepped back in 1993, 94, 95, around there, we didn't really make any distinction between marijuana and hemp because Jack Herer's book made no distinction. It, as far as he was concerned, cannabis sativa, hemp, marijuana, it's all the same. It wasn't until like the later 90s where we started to get a little bit more of an understanding of the difference between marijuana and hemp. And also, we made a conscious decision, I think, to separate those issues so that we don't, you know, we just want, when you talk about hemp, you're talking about hemp. Mm-hmm. Talk about cannabis, you know, you're talking about that.
That was one of the questions.
Two different fights. I mean,
well,
it's,
yeah.
I would say,
more than that, really.
Well, out of all of us here, I'm pretty sure I am the like, most, I don't know what new, but I don't know what word I would use. The newest guy, whatever.
Most inexperienced.
Most inexperienced, most whatever when it comes to marijuana and all that other stuff, okay? I was in the military as well.
Hmm.
I never did it growing up. I was an athlete, never did it, you know, blah, blah, blah. But one thing I wanted to ask you right off the bat was, I read on the website about, you know, how the hemp and marijuana are different. And one of the things it talked about was how hemp has more CBD and less THC, but marijuana is the opposite. Right, has more THC.
Yeah.
So really what I wanted to ask is, what if marijuana and hemp is one of the most common misconceptions that it's the same thing, what is it? Why are they different? What is it that, you know, makes them? Are they just like two different flowers, but they're both flowers kind of thing?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit complicated, but basically there's a male plant and a female plant. The female plant is what produces the buzz. Now, some people mistakenly think that the male plant is hemp and the female plant is marijuana, but that's not true. There's higher THC strains that we call marijuana. I know a lot of people object to that word. We can call it cannabis, whatever potent cannabis. And, then there's mid-range, and then there's really low THC, and then there's extremely low THC strains of industrial hemp that are like 0.3% THC, which if you wanted real marijuana and you got a bag that was 3% THC, you'd probably be very, very disappointed.
Yeah.
You know, if it was 2%, if it was 1%, you'd really be, but 0.3%, you're just not going to be able to get high. But where it gets a little bit more complicated than what most people understand is that there's no reason why some of the higher THC, at least the mid-range THC in the 4 to 10% range or whatever, there's no reason why some of those strains can't be used for industrial hemp purposes too. In Japan, the hemp that they grew both for fiber for clothing and rope and all that stuff, they also smoked because it had a 4 to 8%, in some cases 12% THC ratio. So the reason, you know, why we say 0.3%, it's more for political considerations than anything, is to say out of the hundreds of different strains and varieties, we can grow this many that are considered industrial hemp. But the hemp that our ancestors grew could never have met today's strict standards of industrial hemp. It probably wasn't really mind-blowing, knock-your-socks-off good stuff, but it probably was potent enough that at least when you smoked a pipe full and you probably felt something.
So hemp and marijuana, cannabis, whatever, it's all the same plant. It's just that some have it's different strains of it, basically. Now, these strains, are they a natural occurrence, or is that something that we have done through splicing and things like that, and graphing
to some extent, it's a natural. To some extent, it's natural. I mean, a lot of the industrial hemp strains did exist as very low THC producing strains. Now, I'm not an expert at all. I'm not a geneticist, and I can't really go into the deep scientific history of the cannabis plant, but it's a more of a general understanding from what I understand is that a lot of these strains were specifically developed over the last 40 or 50 years, but the strains that they were developed out of were also pretty much low THC producing strains. From what I understand, a lot of the strains that were grown in Europe were of the low THC variety that had very little resin, and you probably couldn't use it to get high. Although a lot of people made their own tinctures of things, even in the 1800s, 1700s, maybe earlier than that, and they could have been making medicine from the hemp strains. But there was, Japanese strains were higher in THC. There was a strain called Smyrna, which was a lot of people grew for seed, for poultry feed, and so forth. And that was somewhere mid-range in between the drug-producing and the fiber variety. So, but today, when we talk about industrial hemp, we're only allowed to grow strains that are up to 0.3% THC. So there is definitely a difference. And we grew five acres of hemp last year in the Lehigh Valley. And when you're in the field, you can see the leaves. They look like a marijuana leaf, but the plant doesn't really look like a marijuana plant. It's more straight. It doesn't branch out and bush out like a Christmas tree as much. So you can see why police say it looks similar. But
does it produce a bud like a
marijuana plant? It does, but it gets so full of seeds that I took this big cola and dried it out and wanted to see how much bud material it would produce, and it wasn't that much. After I got all the seeds, even though it looked like this huge, enormous bud, it was very little green plant matter. It was just all went in the seed.
And Erica, did you say that's the point of the hemp plant, just to produce more seeds? Is that what you said?
It's one of the major reasons why you grow. If you're growing industrial hemp, you're either growing it for fiber, for seed, or for CBD.
Okay.
And those are the two major components that come out of modern day hemp varietals. And just to clarify a little bit, I mean, so they were probably using hemp and tinctures and stuff like that because it was CBD rich and it was medicinal, but they didn't know what CBD was back then. They just knew that the flower helped with inflammation or whatever it did, and it's only now that we're starting to catch up with understanding why they might have done that. So it's not only THC that has medicinal value, and increasingly we're discovering that CBD potentially has more, more varied applications for it anyway.
It's truly amazing how we've, like when we were in high school, there was good weed, and there was brick weed.
Yeah, regs and nugs.
Right. That's about it. Beasters, maybe. Like, somebody throws some shit out there. And now you can tell me what how much THCA and how much THC fucking B.
Yeah, you could.
There's 600 fucking cannabinoids. You could tell me how much.
With my buddy who lives out in Oregon, and he works on a weed farm and stuff like that. And when I would ask him questions about things, because again, I'm new to all this stuff, he starts talking, and I start thinking to myself, like, do you guys need like a chemistry degree to start doing it? Because like the details. But like the details behind it is just insane, you know. Or like he said that there was a woman who came into their shop the one time, and she, I guess they're doing research where they're trying to just do purely extract CBD and like do this thing, whatever. And so it went from this like, you know, oh, we grow legal marijuana, to now it's turning into this like intense medical thing where they're really trying to hone in on what exactly the thing is and then make it into just pill form as a people can take or something.
Like the CBD oil that's out there now that you can buy on the internet, like there's two different kinds. There's full spectrum extract, which would come from particular CBD plants, but there's also isolate, which has no THC. It's just strictly pulling the cannabidiol out of it. And in that case, once it's extracted, you could not tell whether it was extracted from a marijuana plant or a hemp plant. CBD is CBD.
CBD,
it's
right.
All about the ratios. So, but the full spectrum CBD oil that people take, and unbeknownst to most of them, if you take that for 4 or 5 months, you will eventually fail a drug test. And
there's
so for a lot
of THC in there, sooner or later.
So, you know, if you have a commercial driver's license and you're under the impression that, you know, that, you know, while you'll never get high from it, over time, it would build up.
It'll still show in your system.
But yet the isolate doesn't work as well as the full spectrum because the entourage of all the components work.
Because it's being filtered out more or something.
Well, it's just CBD and nothing else.
Well, back to my original question about what's the difference between hemp and marijuana. It sounds like nothing. It sounds like hemp, marijuana, they are the same plant. It's just that what we call hemp is just a lower grade version of marijuana.
And
marijuana
is
depends,
lower grade.
Right,
well,
depends on what
well,
grade.
Well, judging from a pothead's perspective, it's
a
lower grade.
Too, and I still, like,
I'm not, but that's what I'm. But what I'm trying to say is
the respect for, like, hemp does not get the respect it deserves.
Well, but what I'm saying is that the discussions are never about how much CBD is in something. It's how much THC is in something, right?
Because the discussion that you're having with us generally is
well, right, it's about THC, right?
Trust me, when you're talking to my grandmother or
but, well, no, I understand, but what I'm trying to say is I'm trying to figure out, all right, so there was all this argument about, oh, hemp and marijuana is different, as if it was two totally different plants. But the idea is, no, it's the same plant. It's just that one is a version that has a lower THC.
That's the only difference.
Well, right, but that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So therefore, when people say, oh, hemp and marijuana is the same thing, they are correct. It is the same plant. It's just that they are
unless
different
you're
strains
unless
that are grown differently.
$50
unless
on
you're
a fucking
saying marijuana. Like, if you use the word marijuana, it's commonly agreed upon in society that
you're not making rope out of that
you can get high from.
Right.
So hemp is not marijuana. Hemp and marijuana are both cannabis, but hemp is not marijuana.
Well,
there we go.
Well, you know, I think the distinction of like 0.3% is a little bit arbitrary, and I think 0.3% is set way too low. And I think that in a perfect world, we shouldn't have any THC restrictions on the hemp that we can grow.
What the fuck does it matter?
Right.
And the farmers aren't going to be out there if they're knowingly growing something that's for
something else.
Yeah.
Why in the fuck would my grandfather, who owns a farm, why would he be out smoking his own? And who gives a shit if he is, honestly?
Well, it's not about that. It's, you know, I mean, the idea is that the government is afraid that somebody growing it and saying, oh, I got a license to grow this for industrial purposes, how do they know that they're not behind their backs and also selling it for private use then as well?
They know
and
because,
so
that's, right.
I'm just saying,
yeah,
that's
right.
Where they're coming from, right?
Right.
And as from us, we're coming from the, that's ridiculous. Like you the group you're with now, that you founded and stuff, it's like, it's about growing it for other purposes other than getting high. It's about growing it for the fibers and everything else. So by them putting a restriction on the THC level, it's a way for them to try to say to you, okay, you can do that, but we got to have rules to try to help.
The reason it's 0.3% is because at the time that the world made this agreement of how they were going to handle hemp versus marijuana – France had the highest number of genetics that rated at 0.3% or less. They were growing the most of it in the world, so therefore...
Do it like them.
The, you know, yeah. With the World Trade Association.
So it's France's pussy weed.
It
got us into this situation.
But it's, you know, but when you think about it, with the genetics we have now, it's not a hindrance.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's no reason why we can't develop a full-blown hemp industry with 0.3%.
Right.
But we would have a greater genetic stock to work with if we could, you know, which could be of value, and there's no reason to discard a plant because it's 1.5%.
What's your high-end threshold? Like, what's the high-end? Where are you talking then?
Where does marijuana start is what you're saying,
is that
basically.
What percentage? Yeah.
It's not really what I'm saying. It's an arbitrary number that you're pulling out of thin air at the end of the day.
It's going to stay 0.3% until it becomes just descheduled altogether.
Altogether.
It's either going
to that's
be
the whole thing.
The
is that
the entire plant is legalized?
Yeah. You're never gonna get just hemp legalized.
Right.
It'll
but even
be
if
it has
the
to
United
be the
States were to like it's like Schumer's bill, say it would by some miracle actually pass, and cannabis was all of a sudden descheduled. We would still, for industrial hemp, have to conform with the 0.3% in order to be able to export it to other countries.
Right.
So those standards will always be there until the world evolves, and I don't know that any of us are going to live to see that.
Right.
But a higher percentage THC wouldn't affect the fiber.
But the world has a requirement that, like, if I'm wearing a shirt made out of hemp, they want to know that it was made out of hemp that had 0.3% THC and not,
I wouldn't think.
It's stupid and it's arbitrary, but...
Right. Well, but she's right. Unfortunately, because the world made the rule, the world is the one that's going to have to follow it. Even if in this country it's legal, completely legal, you still got to follow what... If you want to export it anyway.
Exactly. So this whole hemp story goes back into the story of, you know... What started, you know, got me on this passion. And after I went through what I did with arrest, and I read Jack Herer's book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes, and I learned about the history, and he mentioned Hempfield Township in Lancaster County, and I was like, Hempfield? That's where, I'm from Lancaster County. I live in Ephrata. We used to wrestle Hempfield in high school, and I never put two and two together. What's a Hempfield? I never even asked that question. Never heard anybody talk about it. They didn't teach it in school. It was not general knowledge at all in Lancaster County that we used to grow hemp. So I went to the Historical Society. I was going to look up everything that had ever been written about the local hemp industry. And I found out that almost nothing had ever been written.
Forgot all about India.
Well, I had to. That was blown. I had no money.
This is all still from one joint yet.
That's why I say I only ever smoked marijuana one time from 1991 until 2018. So, but anyway, once I found out how deeply ingrained, I went to these tax assessment records in their own old microfiche rolls in each township I went from beginning of Lancaster County, 1729 until like 1840. And it took me weeks, day after day after day, going through these tax records. And I found out everybody had whoever owned a hemp mill. And once I determined who owned the mills and in what townships, then I tried to find out the exact locations of those mills. And I documented that between 1720 and 1870, there were over 100 water-powered mills for processing hemp fiber just in Lancaster County alone, and there were dozens more in all the surrounding counties. I've documented about three dozen hemp mills here in Berks County, and I've found about three dozen hemp mills in York County.
Where in Berks County?
Like in Exeter Township. In Berks County, I don't have all the exact locations. There's one in Exeter Township that was owned by a guy named Daniel Snyder, and we visited that mill. Exeter Township, there was at least three hemp mills, but I don't know their exact locations. There was a guy named Ed Ream, who was a relative of the Reams in Reamstown. They had a hemp mill there, too. There was an Abraham Ream had an oil mill in Reamstown. There was a John Ream had a hemp and oil mill in Reamstown. And one of their descendants moved out this way, and his name was Ream. Spelled it a little bit different. There was variations of the spelling, but that was one.
So, you know, ironically, Pottstown, zero hemp.
No pot.
Well, the founder of Pottstown was a guy named... Potts, or right, and he owned, there was a pot, pot or pots with an S, spelled a little bit different in different years, but he owned a hemp mill out around what's that town where Luke lives?
Burnville.
Burnville. Yeah.
Oh, that makes sense.
Burnville. Yeah.
Yeah. But like,
what makes you wonder, how did Virginville come
over? His brother used to come over from Stonersville.
Yeah.
Burnville. Why is it not illegal in PA first, right?
So I started.
That was my next question.
Yeah.
So, and you'll probably get there. So I should. But like, at what point were they like, okay, fuck this, we got to stop making hemp? It's.
Well, it was a convergence of a lot of different things, you know, and like in school, we were always taught that in 1794, we were always taught that Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, and that made the mass production of cotton more feasible. Well, up in the Northeast, we didn't raise any cotton. We only used 3 fibers for making homespun clothing, and we made 90% of our clothing was homespun. It was only used hemp, flax, and wool. And of those three, hemp was one of the most important. So the first, even though we think of it as a coarse thing for rugs.
Hemp clothing?
Yes, it was the number one fiber for homespun clothing. And they say the Pennsylvania Dutch people. They say the Pennsylvania Dutch people grew some of the best hemp in the world, and they made some of the finest hemp linens. If you took the finest flax linen, the best hemp linen, put it side by side, you couldn't tell the difference. The Pennsylvania Dutch people had developed the linen industry to a high degree. That's why we have a textile industry from then on up until the 1970s or so around here, maybe even a little later. So after the cotton gin was invented in 1794 or so, it took about 20, 30, 40 years before it really started up here in the Northeast. We started making factories to produce cotton textiles. And by 1840, I think most people said, heck with this stuff, huh? I'm not growing that. I'm going to the store, I'm buying a shirt, you know. But it still hung in there. And even in up till 1850 in Lancaster County, they still produced 540.5 tons of hemp. I have, I have several newspaper clippings from Berks County here in the 1880s where they were really, they said the crop was really large here and so forth. So it hung on in pockets here and there. By 1840, the age of homespun was over. But then you had the introduction of wire rope, and which lessened the demand for hemp rope in the seas. You know, down in Philadelphia, we had a big shipbuilding industry, and every ship that sailed the seas took between 60 to 100 tons of hemp for all the big, thick anchor cables, all the rope rigging, all the canvas sails, and all that hemp had to be replaced every couple years. So that ensured an enormous and insatiable demand for hemp from the interior of Pennsylvania. Matter of fact, we couldn't even grow enough hemp to meet the demand, so a lot of it was being imported. And then increasingly, they started increasing, because over in Russia, they used serf labor. They could actually produce hemp cheaper in Russia, send it all the way to Philadelphia, cheaper than the farmers of Berks and Lancaster County could grow their hemp and send it down to Philly from here. So, we started getting flooded with cheaper imported fibers from Russia and other countries. And then you had, jute, sisal, and so forth. And now the industry started to shift from Pennsylvania to, the Midwest, states like Kentucky and Missouri and Indiana. And they made use of slave labor. We no longer had slaves. So there, and hemp, it was a very labor-intensive crop. So for a lot of those reasons, the industry started to shift. But it hung on in little pockets here and there throughout the state all the way up until the late 1930s. So when I found out all this stuff, that's what just gave me this passion to know. And then the more and more I learned was that medical cannabis has a deep history in Pennsylvania too. Back in 1846, a guy named Dr. Isaac Heaster, who was from a very famous and influential Heaster family in Redding and Berks County, but he was a physician. As physician in Reading, Dr. Isaac Heaster, he cured a guy named Charles Sassaman of lockjaw with cannabis indica in 1846, and he published his findings in scientific medical journals of the day. It led to a boom, an explosion in medical cannabis use all throughout the country, and over the next 10 years or so, by the 1850s, medical cannabis was available in every pharmacy throughout the state and advertised in all the early newspapers. And, even recreate. And then there's so many people that started up their medical cannabis companies from Pennsylvania. There was, so many characters. Robert C. Kopp in York made something called Kopp syrup with cannabis. down in Glen Olden, H.K. Mulford. Glen Olden's a suburb of Philly, and in the early 1900s, they were growing huge fields of cannabis that looked as big as Christmas trees, you know, making their own cannabis medicines. And then even the recreational side. I have an article from the 1880s in Philadelphia talking about their visit to a hashish house where they went in and smoked hash. Matter of fact, in the 1880s, these hemp hash houses were all up and down the East Coast and every major city. New York City had, during Prohibition, there were more hash houses in New York than there were speakeasies. But when you find out this deep history, and then to think that they wanted to put me in jail for getting my friend a half ounce of cannabis. And I just, you know, and then when I thought about it, and I thought, you know what happened to me was absolutely nothing compared to the hundreds of thousands of people who get arrested every year and have their lives either ruined or severely interrupted by arrest.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, since 1965, since the date of my birth, there have been over 25 million people who have been arrested for cannabis offenses in America who have collectively served over 20 million years in prison. And when you think about that collective suffering, the treasury and human lives wasted over the pursuit of a policy that anybody who can objectively look at it and agree that has drastically failed. And it just I like to take it on a local level here in Pennsylvania. There's 25,000 people arrested every year for either possession, cultivation, or sales. That means in the last 10 years, about 250,000 Pennsylvania citizens have had their lives ruined or severely altered by arrest. And if we don't do anything, over the next 10 years, over 250,000 more Pennsylvania citizens will have their lives ruined at a cost of about $1 billion to the taxpayers and of no benefit whatsoever. So, you know, we're coming up on May 22nd, a little less than 2 weeks here, is the 85-year anniversary of the birth of marijuana prohibition in Pennsylvania. It was signed into law in 1933, January 1933, a local person from West Lawn, his name was Chester A. Moen, M-O-H-N. His ancestors were the founders of Moton. And Chester
West Lawn right over here.
Yes, where Wilson High School is. So, Chester Moen came out. He had, you know, he was local, active in the local community for a lot of years, and he got elected. He was the only conservative in Berks County at that time. Back then in the 30s, Berks County was a lot more radical than it is now. There was socialist, actually, and communist parties and really liberals, because it was a crazy time. It was the Great Depression.
Mafia.
And, there was all kinds of stuff back then. But Chester Moen got in there, and by March, 2 months in, he introduced a bill to ban marijuana because he said that there was a police officer got in a fight with a Mexican on, 9th Street or something, 7th Street, I think, and Penn in Renton, and the guy was on weed. So Moen introduced this bill in March of 1933, and it passed in record time. It passed on May 22nd and was signed into law by Governor Gifford Pinchot, May 22nd, 1933. So coming up is the 85-year anniversary.
Is Pennsylvania the first state to outlaw marijuana?
I always tell people with Pennsylvania, we're never the first to do anything, but we're never the last. People always say we're going to be the last. We're never the last. We're always usually in the middle of the pack or so. In this case, there were already over 30 states that had made marijuana illegal by the time that we did.
And marijuana was made illegal as a, and this is like a documented thing, but it was made as a deterrent for ethnic or minorities, I guess. It was supposed to be a drug that was linked to minorities as a way to, you know,
racism had
keep
a lot
them down or whatever.
Racism definitely had a big play in it. But we made it illegal 4 years before the federal government did in August 2nd.
Cocaine is my
August 2nd, 1937 is when the federal prohibition of marijuana did. But by the time the federal government did make it illegal in 1937, almost every other state did. And California was one of the very first states, like something like 1910, 1914, or somewhere around there. In that first, that decade, a lot of the southwestern states up into the 20s, they started making it illegal first because there was a large Mexican population there. And it's not just a stereotype. It was a part of their culture, from what I can tell. And it was, so there, racism was a component. There's so many different things factored in. You know, back then it was just a different time morally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was looking through arrest records from the 30s because I was trying to figure out who was the first person to get arrested in Lancaster County. I couldn't believe one of the biggest charges was fornication. You imagine getting arrested for fornication.
It's a broad brush also.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And then, you had movie censors. I mean, if you kissed had a kiss, you had to keep your foot in the ground. You know, if you got too out of line, you couldn't even, Everything was so different. I mean, alcohol prohibition, that movement started in the 1860s or something like, as far back as maybe even before that. It took generations for that to take hold, but people just hated anything that wasn't, Christian.
Right. Oh, right. I mean, but think about this, though, too. So looking at the history, all right, mm-hmm. you saw that, like, California was the first to make it illegal, and it continued, and most of these states had it illegal, and then finally the federal government was like, it's illegal everywhere.
Right.
Now look at what's happening. It's the reverse.
Right.
Following the same pattern.
Exactly.
California was one of the first. Oregon. All these states are starting to pass it. Medical, legal, whatever. Next thing you know, the federal government's going to have to say, okay, it's legal. So at least we're going back up,
but
legal government, if the federal government just said, hey, we don't fucking care, that's all we would need.
Right, but we have to force it to happen because they're not just going to say it until we build it. You know, when you're trying to ratify a constitutional amendment, you have to have 35 states. Well, when it comes to trying to force the federal government to take action, it's different than trying to ratify a constitutional amendment because there is no magic number. It's not 35. We don't know how many states it takes. Who knows? You never know if the federal government's that stubborn that you got 40 states and they'll still – no. But I think that we're very close. We're getting to that tipping point. We got 9 states already. Vermont's a little – they don't have full-blown commercial sales. And Maine just passed legislation – finally overrode the veto of the governor there. So not all the systems are in place yet, but there's 9 states where it's legal plus DC. And in November, Michigan's going to vote on it. And it's almost certain that Michigan will say yes.
It's going up there again. It'll be legal in the future for sure.
It will.
Like, it's going.
That's
that
the
way.
Direction that we're going.
So even with the hemp stuff and everything else, it's like again, like we were talking about. Even though maybe you can't specifically get the industrial hemp to be legal right now,
But we will. Hemp is already been.
Hemp will be legalized before adult use
probably a few months. That's how close we are.
Oh, wow.
Nationwide. It is legal in PA
under the umbrella those stipulations of 3% or 0.3%.
And also has to have a research component.
So
my grandfather can't grow hemp.
Yes, he can. He just has to get a permit from the Department of Ag. And the standards of research
to grow anything.
Right. Really. The standards of research are pretty low. He could say, I want to see how it grows in limestone soil. Yeah, you know what I mean.
So it's like a scientific purpose of doing. I gotcha.
But it's pretty loose in what that research is. He can. It's because commercial sales are not allowed. But anything that's produced within the research program is still under the umbrella of the research. So it's called marketing research.
Well,
seems like a really tricky situation.
Well, let me ask you something,
my 85-year-old grandfather to have.
Well,
yeah. Well, let me ask you something though. All right, so if hemp growing is legal in PA right now, right, but not nationally, is there a problem with people in PA trying to grow hemp and sell it? Because I know, like, my buddy in Oregon with marijuana being legal.
What we're doing in Pennsylvania is legal federally.
Because what I was going to say is, in Oregon, in this marijuana farm, they have a problem with basically you need to have a lot of money to even start up because banks are federal. you can't get like loans to start
a
marijuana. That's why. So banking is also a problem for him.
Yeah,
okay.
Everything has to be cash.
That's what
right?
I was getting at.
Cash
is that
business,
it's
right?
more it's
some
harder to get it going.
There is a federally legal path to growing hemp, so okay. the
taxes
banks
and stuff like
theoretically
that
should not discriminate against hemp because it's not money laundering.
Right.
But so some banks are, you know, willing to work with hemp farmers. Mm-hmm. A lot are not, and we're actually working very hard to get some guidance letters from several states and from the Secretary of Treasury's office to give guidance to banks that hemp production under state pilot programs is legal.
Right. But what's really exciting, I mean, everything that's been done has been done on two flimsy paragraphs, pretty skimpy paragraphs, Section 7606 of the 2014 Farm Bill. Well, every 4 years, the Farm Bill must pass. Unlike other legislation, it doesn't have to pass. If it dies, it's no problem. But the Farm Bill must pass every 4 years. So now we have the most powerful senator in the Senate, majority leader, Mitch McConnell. And, you know, I disagree with 95% of his politics, but he's on our side with hemp. And it's because he's from Kentucky. His Kentucky people talked him into it, Senator Rand Paul and new Representative Congressman James Comer, who was the former Ag Secretary of Kentucky. And they talked him into it, and they said, look, we got a big opportunity for Kentucky here and the country. So he's pushing it. And the thing about it is he introduced this bill. Now he decided that instead of trying to pass that bill, he's going to attach it to the must-pass Farm Bill. And the Farm Bill is going to come out of committee. He expects it to come out this month, and he wants to act on it as soon as possible. As soon as it comes out of committee, he's going to send it to the Senate floor for a vote. I have to go to the House, and it will have a little bit of work to do there. But it must pass out of House, too.
So, it's not going to. They're going to most likely extend it for 6 months, and it won't pass until it's complicated. But
well, it's right around.
Well, it's nice to see somebody trying to use that shitty loophole of attaching things
right,
to other
right.
things for something good
is
for
germane,
once.
Though. I mean, because the original language that legalized hemp in the first place is in the Farm Bill.
Right.
So amending clarification to the legalization of hemp in the Farm Bill is appropriate.
Right. Well, I just mean the whole, like, oh, here's a bill for whatever,
know,
but
right.
attach an extra thing to it. It's like they do it all the time, like stupid things. Yeah.
Agreed.
But, you know, so basically what the point is that we're just right around the corner. Like, by next growing season, I can pretty much confidently say that industrial hemp will be legal on a federal level, full-blown commercialization. There'll still be limitations. You have to, you know, follow the 0.3% guidelines,
right.
and you'll still have to, like, get a permit from the state, but it'll be unlimited amount. This year, they were going to give out 50 permits. You can grow up to 100 acres per permit. They got 39 applications, and about 1,200 acres are going to be grown. Our team, under the umbrella of the Pennsylvania Hemp Industry Council, and Erica's the one who puts these projects together. She does all the work. There's a guy who's grown for 60 acres in Ole. And we got several projects here in Berks County. Our team's grown over 200 acres between Berks and Lehigh County. So you're going to see it really exploding. We're building a hemp manufacturing plant, and Erica and the team, Jeff Whalen, have worked tirelessly for the last year and a half. And it's looking like it's going to happen, bringing a hemp processing plant to the Lehigh Valley. Once it gets working up to full capacity, it'll be able to process up to 14,000 acres of hemp per year from farmers within a 50-mile radius.
You're
going to see hemp exploding.
I got a question, a little more on the not-so-serious of the law side. But so I watched that video of you physically breaking up the hemp with that
hemp
wood
break.
Horse or whatever.
Called a break.
And first I can say is, fuck that. Okay. You look like you're going to pass out after you broke that
thing. Well, I'm a smoker, right? You know, I'm a little out of shape.
You know, the best
is
you were like, you know, you could see doing this all day. I'm like, hell no. Yeah. So my question is, when you go to commercially farm the material.
No, nobody's going
to
do it.
They just collect it and then send it to the plant or whatever, they would just stick it in one end of a machine, and that machine would knock the seeds off, break all the whatever, and then out comes the hemp inside.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Okay.
It's done that when it's harvested, the combine, it's a special combine that can harvests a seed head because these plants are like 15 feet tall.
Right.
It harvests the seed, strips the leaves to be used for CBD extraction, and then it chops the stalks into two lengths to lay in the field. And then it's after it lays in the field for
to dry or whatever, right? Okay.
Right. You flip it once, let it dry, red a little bit more, and then it gets baled into square bales. And then those bales are what's taken to the processing facility. So by the time it reaches the processing facility, the seeds and the flower, the green plant material
that's
has already been stripped away.
Okay, cool.
Holy fucking science.
Yeah, matter of fact, this is amazing because if we are successful, and it looks like we're going to, thanks to her hard work, get the hemp processing plant here. They're going to bring their own harvesting machinery. And anybody who...
the coolest machine I've ever
heard. Yeah. Anybody who grows for us...
Well, that's why I was like, it's 2018. It's got to be a way where it just goes in one end and out the other end comes a t-shirt. You know what I mean? Like,
by the time it spits out of the fucking tractor, it's ready to go.
There's only one of those combines in the United States right now. And we have to bring another one in. And that's the struggle that the industry has is the infrastructure. Because these machines are over like $1 million.
They're GPS operated. You don't even need to.
I understand that, yeah.
And nobody's been willing to invest in it until.
Well, until it's legal and stuff like that. That's going to be the problem, yeah.
It's got to ramp up slow.
Right. And that's why I asked originally about the bank thing, because I know that financially it's a problem out there. Even though it's legal, it's still a problem to get even started because nobody has that kind of money just laying around to, you know.
Well, once this legislation passes, I think a lot of these problems are going to go away.
Yeah. 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 That's great.
I had a question. You're talking about the history of the legalization and where it was hemp and marijuana made illegal at the same time, or what?
Basically, how did that work? They didn't really distinguish. They didn't say they were going to try to ban hemp. It's just that
it just got categorized into one.
Yeah, right.
But again, that's why I said it is all one plant. Right. It's just that there's different varieties of it.
Right.
Exactly.
THC wasn't known until it was discovered and isolated in a lab by an Israeli chemist in the early 60s. Before that, they had different field tests, but they were very inaccurate. They mainly just said presence of THC.
Right.
But except for they didn't even know it was THC. Some kind of cannabinoid or whatever. Right.
Something so, turned this demon's eye.
Yeah.
So up until the 1960s, there was no such thing as THC.
I don't know.
I think they knew it was in there.
They knew that there was some kind of principle.
THC.
Right. They knew there was some kind of principle in there that,
Wonderful time.
Yeah. They didn't give a fuck. They just wanted to smoke it. They didn't care what was
in there. And there might have been certain scientists with a little bit more advanced knowledge, but the average cop, no.
Right.
Sure, yeah.
Whereas now, it's like we can clone a mammoth if we wanted to. Like now it's like a whole different ballgame, you know. Now they're like, oh, it turns out that they all have chocolate in it as well, and you can make cocoa out of it. I don't know.
So one of the coolest stories is, the reason why we know that they were still growing hemp in the late 1930s is actually because of the reports of the farmers being arrested in the late 1930s. In Lancaster County, one of the first people that we know of and can prove that was arrested was an 81-year-old farmer, hemp farmer named Enos Schaefer. Enos Schaefer was arrested on July 5th, 1938. And he had a long strip of hemp growing alongside of his garden, and he admitted that he was growing it, but he said that he had no idea whatsoever that it was illegal. Because
he'd probably been growing it for how many years, right?
As far as he was concerned, he was growing hemp. And when he sat and testified in front of the judge, he told the judge, I've been growing this my whole life. He said, my dad grew it. We always grew it. We always collected the seeds and fed them to the chickens. Uh-huh. So
those chickens were the laziest chickens.
but they were easy as fuck to catch. Yeah.
That's actually how I found out about the law in Pennsylvania, because a lot has been written about federal prohibition and how that all came about with Harry Anslinger and the whole cast of characters in Jack Harris' book. He talks about it a lot, but nobody had ever really investigated Pennsylvania. So I saw this little tiny blurb 75 years ago, Enos Schaefer, and then so I went and got that newspaper, got the whole story, and then I used that and went to the courthouse and got his arrest records, and they had the law that he was charged under. I went to the law library, got the book, and figured out, when this law was passed in Pennsylvania, because nobody, you could do research online, and it's very, very, very hard, if not impossible, to find the fact that it was banned here on May 22nd, 1933, and went into effect September 1st, 1933. It was signed by Governor Gifford Pinchot, and, you know, those facts just, nobody really knows that. And so I'm trying to force federal change by changing as many states, and we're trying, if we could change Pennsylvania, that will do more to force the federal government's hand than anything I can go do in D.C. When I'm down in D.C., all my lobbying on a federal level, to me, has felt like it had the effect of shooting rubber bands at the star, the moon.
Oh, yeah. You're just one little noise being shouted out, and they got a whole crowd of people
tossing pebbles at
the
castle walls from across the moat.
Yep.
But here in Pennsylvania, a small group of committed people can actually change things.
Absolutely.
Especially when you do it city by city. When you go to a city council, you're only dealing with 7, 8, 9 council members and so forth. And when you make enough change in enough cities, you force statewide change. And, you know, we proved it with the medical marijuana movement. It was a big movement, but it wasn't that huge. There was about 300 people that were dedicated in the movement, a couple dozen leaders, and, you know, thousands of people who did a little bit. But we passed hemp like SEAL Team 6. It was basically me, Erica, our friend Jeff Whaling, and about 24 people that we sometimes organize to help us. And so we found out that, you know, you can do things. You know, people don't realize, you know, sometimes they say, well, why doesn't the government just do this, you know, legalize it? Well, sometimes it's, you know, you just have to, you know, ask. It's like I heard this comedian say, he was walking down the street and there's this homeless guy. He saw him every day. The guy's walking around going, hey, hey, hey. And he said, you know, one of these days I thought, you know, I'm going to. So the guy said, hey. And he goes, yeah, what? What's up? So I was just wondering, at what rate do you think the universe is expanding? You know, something like that, right? You know, well, a lot with the government, it's like, you know, they're not going to do it unless we demand it. Yeah. And when the people, you know, we're going to create this tipping point where enough people are active and involved. And that's why I want people to come to our press conference on May 22nd at 2:30 in the afternoon in the main rotunda of Harrisburg. We're going to have a press conference that's going to talk about the 85-year anniversary of the birth of marijuana prohibition in Pennsylvania. And it's, I don't anticipate there's going to be a lot of people there, but we want as many people as we can get. And then we're going to be announcing a big rally that's going to happen in September, which is going to commemorate the 85-year anniversary of the day that marijuana prohibition went into effect in Pennsylvania. And we're going to have all summer to build that one up, and I think we can get a big audience there. That's why I'm calling this one on May 22nd a press conference, because if you call it a press conference and you get 20 people there, then that's pretty nice.
Positive thing, yeah.
Positive press conference. If you called it a rally, you'd be so embarrassed. It's very weak.
Yeah.
And when you only have a couple weeks to get people together, I thought I'm calling this one a press conference. But then we're announcing the big rally in September, and we think we can get 400 or 500 people there.
That's great. They always say you should start locally. Go locally, and it'll grow and grow and grow.
Definitely.
Just like Cat Buddy.
You know, you fight where you stand. And I always tell people, where we fight, we win. And we find this. You're from Bethlehem. Coming up also on May 22nd, the same day as the rallies, we're going to have a little bit busy because I'm going to go to Harrisburg from 2:30 to 3:30 for the press conference. And then I'm booking right out of there, heading up to Bethlehem, because Bethlehem City Council is having a meeting to discuss decriminalization on May 22nd.
Which their police chief doesn't want anything to do with.
Yeah.
Which is funny, because he's about the same age and looks just like fat fucking Wally Scott, who also walks out of the fucking room when you start talking about anything marijuana related. So,
well, you know,
I see a fucking very common, this mentality that it's like they've watched fucking Reefer Madness too many times that they think it's real.
Well, did you see the thing in Houston? I think you posted it on your on the Keystone Cannabis thing on on Facebook about the police chief and all those guys.
Oh, about the CBD.
Yeah,
somebody
the CBD,
posted that in the group.
The CBD stuff in Houston.
Hmm.
They were acting like they made a huge drug bust. They went into like a head shop and took CBD stuff off
which
the shelf.
Which is legal.
He kept saying Kush, though, like it was the, I don't know if you saw the video. He kept saying Kush like it was like the something so dangerous, you know.
Right.
Like, he didn't even know what he was saying.
Back to, you said no, it's not. It's not legal?
Not by the strict definition of the law.
Why is that? Because there's still small hints of THC in it, or?
No, it's because.
There's only one way to get it, and you have to have it.
No, I mean, you can make an argument that if it was grown under a state-authorized pilot program and sold within that state in which it was produced, that it's covered by the federal farm bill, and it would, in that sense, be legal. That's not where CBD in head shops is coming from. So the people who are mass producing CBD, technically it is not legal. But regardless of whether a lawyer can make an argument one way or the other, and we can all agree that the law is stupid, but the DEA considers CBD to be marijuana. I mean, I sat in a room with them at the big polished mahogany table and the, you know, crime unit things up on the wall. And that's their position. So until the law changes, now we all know millions and millions of dollars of it are being sold every day all across this country. Everybody that sells it.
Grandmothers all across the country.
And it works for a lot of people, but a lot of the product is not what it says it is. If you took it to a lab, it would not test out to be.
Which is a huge problem. But
it's
that's why it needs
to be legalized so that they can regulate it.
That's absolutely right.
And
that's absolutely
right.
My point was going to be if they had common sense about it and said, okay, well, fuck it. It works for this one fucking person. I don't give a fuck if it worked for one girl, like one 3-year-old girl that was having 100 fucking seizures a day and it stopped her from having one more fucking seizure. Mm-hmm. It should be fucking across the board.
Absolutely.
Right. There's as big a black market for CBD as there is for marijuana.
But the reason why it doesn't happen is because it's as if they found a miracle cure for cancer and they're like, well, we know it cures it, but we're not going to make it legal yet. That's not the problem, right? They know that it does help people with different situations. The problem is that there's this social stereotype that's stuck on it that people grow up with thinking it's a negative thing, it's bad. If you take it, it's going to ruin your lives, all this other stuff. So now.
But we think like that generation, about fucking alcohol, about driving like an asshole, about fucking caffeine, cigarettes.
My point is the people who are in the positions of power to be able to change that stuff tomorrow 100%. are still the ones that grew up with it. Now, we were kids with the D.A.R.E. program, but we're talking about people who were adults with the D.A.R.E. program.
But personally, it's for them. The ones who are still hardline prohibitionists against marijuana as a whole, CBD is that component where hemp and marijuana intersect.
Right, that's what makes them
the
exact same.
They don't understand the science. They don't understand the differentiation.
But the burden, that should be on them then, not on us.
It should be, and is not
100% correct. You're 100% correct.
If you think about it,
their ignorance is the problem, not the fact that it's a drug. You know,
it will change, just like how it started with one state making it illegal, and now it started with one state making it legal
and
again.
And all this time that we have all these fucking grown men, women, and a bunch of children arguing in Washington about this shit. There's people that it could help that it's not.
Well,
helping.
Right, but
that,
it's but that's in history all over the place.
Stupid.
You know what I mean?
You know, anybody who's 70 years old or younger. Up to 70 years old should be on our side if you think about it, because if you're 70 years old, you were like a teenager when Woodstock was going on.
Right.
So it's not like they're that naive, that generation. Once the people over 70, 80, that's a little bit out of their time. But
even when you have people on your side, it irritates me when they're like, you know, with decriminalization, well, nobody should be punished for the rest of their lives for a mistake they made in their youth. And it's like, but it was never a mistake to begin with. There was never anything wrong with it. It's like,
well, it's not like, oops, you know, I'm trying to make people realize, like, as a leader of KCC, I have to inject as much optimism as I can. So I like to talk about all the progress that we're making with, you know, we're going to have over 1,200 acres of industrial hemp growing in the fields. We got the medical marijuana passed, and the growers are starting to display. We're going into phase two, actually. So pretty soon we'll have 150 dispensaries and 25 growers, and plus research being done. And we have decriminalized cannabis in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, Harrisburg State College.
Harrisburg?
Yes, we passed it out on July 5th, which was the anniversary of the day that Ina Schaefer got arrested.
See, that's great. That's great because so, cities and then it'll spread.
That's
out.
Right. Yeah. So we got six cities so far. Let me see if I can rattle them off real quick: Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Erie State College, York, and Harrisburg. And then we passed a resolution of support for statewide decriminalization here in Reading, and they've passed the same kind of resolution in Easton, and now Allentown is going to vote this coming Wednesday at 7 o'clock. They're going to vote on whether or not to pass their decrim ordinance. I think it will, but there's where the problem with the DA, Jim Martin. But then May 22nd, you got Bethlehem that's going to vote on it, so that'll be 10 states. I'm in talks with a councilman from Lancaster City Council, and we're going to move forward in Lancaster within the next several months. And then I'm talking to so you know, all this is going to force statewide decram. So I always try, as the leader of KCC, I try to inject that optimism. Look,
absolutely,
because you have to have a feeling that if I fight, we can win. Because if you have the feeling of hopelessness, but what I also want people to understand is, even as we're making all this progress, arrests aren't going down; they're increasing. There is actually more arrest over the last couple of years, and it's going up. And we're wondering, why is this? And I think there could be several factors. Maybe people are just feeling like, look, it seems like it's getting legal and they're more open with it, maybe.
I think people are just confused about where it's legal and where it's not.
Or are the police intentionally cracking down on marijuana because they see...
Let's pause for a second, though. The people that are... The arrests that are increasing, are they people that are sitting at home fucking enjoying a fucking bowl by themselves?
I don't know the circumstances.
Or is it that dumbass who's in front of me at Subway taking an hour to order a fucking ham and cheese sandwich?
Are they flying down 422 smoking a fucking joint and getting pulled over?
I don't know the circumstances of every arrest, but the fact is, I mean, there's been relatively 20,000 arrests per year for year after year after year. I mean, it's escalating, not like by orders of magnitude increasing, but the increase is by hundreds of arrests or over 1,000 arrests a year. It's got up to, I think in the last year, my friend Chris Goldstein from Philly Normal, now with South Philly Normal, he's really good at crunching the numbers, and I get a lot of my stats and statistics from him. And he pointed out, I think it was last year in 2017, there was something like 27,000 arrests for possession, cultivation, and sales all together. 27,000 people. That's why I always say over the next 10 years, over 250,000 people are going to get arrested, in spite of the fact that we'll have hemp flourishing everywhere, right, in spite of the fact that we have medical marijuana, in spite of the fact that we have decriminalization, because a lot of these cities aren't enforcing the local ordinances.
I would be willing to bet everything I own that it's not a conspiracy by the police cracking down. I believe that it's more simply, and this is something you can't prove because it's just an arbitrary idea. You can't, like, you know, go around questioning everybody. But I guarantee you it's that people think, oh, they legalized it in California, it's got to be legal here or something. Or people are just more open about doing it and not realizing that, well, technically, it's illegal here. Plus, and now it'd be like smoking right in front of a cop.
The police are still more aware of it
just as much as the people. Yeah.
I mean, so the cops still know that it's there. The cops aren't fucking stupid. And
that's their job,
6 million
too.
Ways to fucking smoke weed.
Right.
But I believe it's definitely got to be the fact that because it's talked about more, because it's more acceptable now to come out and be like, yeah, I smoke weed, you know, whereas it used to be like a hush-hush, like making hand gestures.
Even the laws, like there was a skit on SNL a few years ago when they made it legal in New York. Well, they decriminalized it.
That was great.
All the potheads heard on TV, on the news, that it was legalized. And they all come out of their houses and they're like all looking around and they see each other and they're all skipping down down the street together, all getting. And as soon as the guy goes to light a joint, he's right in front of the cop. The cop goes, what are you doing? He goes, it's legal now. Haven't you heard? He goes, yeah, not outside. So everybody just like,
they all looked at
like, they all went back inside.
But it's that situation right there. It's probably why there's been an increase in arrests and stuff is because people are misunderstanding exactly where it's at in its legalization.
But you know, we can debate how prohibition got started. Was it racism? Was it a collusion of industries that were affected by hemp? Was it, you know, was it for like the moralist side of society? I mean, and we can debate on why it's continuing. We can debate on all this, on the reasons of the increased arrest. But what I want everybody to do is to focus on the solution. The solution is to come together with collective voice and making our presence felt at these rallies and talking to our legislators and really working together to get these laws changed. And it's not as big of a boulder to push uphill as one might believe. We're not destined to repeat this cycle forever. I look at it, I say that, you know, our fate is, you know, you can see it basically within our sights, but it's not automatic. It's not preordained. But it's like our future is sort of like a rolled up carpet. If you sit there and stare at it and don't do anything, it will never unroll itself. But if everybody pushes in and pushes, it will actually unfold very easily. And that's what's going to happen with our movement.
Right. Yeah, you hear that, millennials? You're not entitled, you bastards.
And there are some politicians in Pennsylvania now that are behind it, right? Like I see this John Fetterman that's coming up.
Oh, yeah.
He's a big... advocate of it, right?
John Fetterman's running for lieutenant governor, and he's from Braddock, Pennsylvania. And John Fetterman is great. KCC endorses him. We need to elect him as lieutenant governor.
He's a big bald dude, isn't he?
Big bald guy. He's like, very tall, like upper 6 feet. He's a great guy, good progressive values, but he supports us in legalization. The current lieutenant governor is Mike Stack, and 4 years ago we endorsed him. Because when he was a state senator, he had introduced a bill for decriminalization, and we were excited to get him in there on the Wolf ticket. But since then, he hasn't really done a lot for us. And we got Fetterman coming along with all this energy, and I just have a feeling that we get him in there, he's going to use the bully pulpit, and he'll have a bug in Wolf's ear to like push. Wolf was a little reluctant on legalization. Strong supporter of decrim. He's on the fence. 4 years ago, he was saying wait and see, which was legitimate.
But he's all for hemp. I mean,
he's all for hemp.
Yeah, he's an industrial.
He loves it. He helped us out and with hemp, and he's all for medical. He's all for decrim, I think he's a little bit afraid of the issue politically. But if Fetterman gets in, that'll send a message to him. So, but if Stack wins on next Tuesday, it's not a complete disaster. He's still kind of on our side. He's just more wishy-washy about it. And so, this Tuesday, May 15th, when everybody get out of primaries and vote for Fetterman for lieutenant governor. And then get him on the ticket, and it'll be Wolf Fetterman in November. And that's what we really want to push for, create the conditions. But we have to leave here in a minute or two, so we want to wrap it up.
Sure, absolutely. Where can people find you at? Can they purchase your book?
Well, we'll put a link up for sure.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, and
anybody
please,
listening to this podcast will find
it. Yeah, we have a website, KeystoneCannabisCoalition.org. Follow us on Facebook, Keystone Cannabis Coalition. We have a main page, and then we have a group page. And the main page is good for sharing information. But in the group page, we talk in more detail about all our strategy, everything that's going on.
In code?
No, we're pretty much open. It's a closed group. It's a closed group, so nobody sees what we talk about. Sure. But we only talk about, we try to stay focused on the mission of changing the laws. I don't like to talk about, actually, you said about the article about the CBD raid in Texas it was.
Yeah.
Someone did post that in the group. I deleted it because our mission is to change the laws of Pennsylvania
right.
And I don't want to talk, you know, a raid in Texas isn't generally related to what we're trying to do.
Right.
It's important to know, but if we fill up the page with every interesting thing that goes on in the cannabis world, then we'll have to scroll for 2 hours to get to what's really important.
A bunch of hillbillies in Texas start shooting the place up over some CBD.
It's important to know about. I want people to get that information because there's a million other pages, a million other websites, magazines, and all that stuff, and we can all stay informed on everything that's going on in the whole wide world of cannabis there. But in the group, I want us to focus on the mission of what's going on in Pennsylvania and what can we do about it.
Well, dude, I really appreciate you. We all really appreciate it.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks for having
great.
Us here.
Anytime, you're welcome back. I'm sure we'll keep in touch.
All right.
And thanks again.
Peace.
Yeah, thank you, man.
Go green.
What else are we going to talk about? Oh. I don't think we need to get into
Cobra Kai.
No, no, not yet.
Serious?
Wait.
Are
we need
all
to have
the same
a,
time. Yeah, no, are we on the same side?
Yeah. I don't know. Jeff with might what? Be on the on Uh-oh. The fringe.
Uh-oh. Johnny's the asshole.
Huh?
Johnny's the asshole.
Oh, yeah, I said on the phone. I said Johnny is clearly a bully.
Right.
I said, but there were situations where which, Danny made it worse.
Which yeah. I don't want to get into yet.
Right, he doesn't want to get into that yet.
Next week, next we are going to have a full episode
Cobra Kai
on The Karate Kid right, and Cobra Kai.
But let's just say this, though. We're on the same page in that great show, though.
Cobra
right?
Kai is fucking awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Already
fantastic.
Coming out. They already yeah. ready for season.
They should. They should.
We've been watching it at work. It's been
they should week. Just book three more seasons right now immediately.
Yeah, right out of the way.
Because yeah. like
they
the,
already have a second one.
The second one's almost out.
The one. The it's almost out.
No, no. 2019. I think it said.
Oh, okay.
Oh
but wait, but it's already like green lighted.
Yeah, yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Because you know?
One of the best. I don't know how far Jimmy got into it. But I'll just touch on this yeah, very, very lightly. The episode where they hang out, where Johnny and Daniel hang out.
Okay. Oh. Oh. Yeah.
And and then he's like, oh, this is never going to be over.
yeah.
So I mean, hopefully they just greenlight it for quite
but it gave
a while.
You, but it gave you that feeling, like, because you ever watch a movie when you're like, oh, if those two would just fucking have a drink together, they'd be best friends. And this is that situation. We're like, yeah. Like, oh shit! I almost broke this fucking chair.
It's your chair.
But yeah. But yeah, that,
yeah,
the,
next
the
week,
biggest consensus of that show is, like my one buddy said, he goes, that show is way better than it should have been.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
Well, they make it 80s, like, cheesy, well, which is...
But it's, like, so relevant, and, like, it hits so... Like, if you think about the original Karate Kid movie... Again, we should
let's not get into
yeah.
this.
But what I was saying, like, the Karate Kid movie was simple, you know? Like, there was, like, one plot, one thing. And this is, like, there's, like, six
yeah,
different
yeah,
things
it's
going on.
Good.
It's great.
Yeah, next week is going to be strictly Karate Kid discussion.
Yeah.
Because Jeff, I told Jimmy this. I think I might have told you this the other day on the phone. I've never taken notes in my life except for when I watched The Karate Kid.
You
and I watched it a second time now, and I took more notes.
You watched Karate Kid twice? To think Wow, you did like legit research. So,
and I think
it.
When I got here, I think I saw notes on Jimmy's screen as well.
13 minutes into the movie, Danny introduces himself to a girl.
13 minutes.
She is single.
I actually
Johnny proceeds to confront her, destroy her radio, and beat Danny to a pulp after trying to interject. At 17 minutes and 30 seconds, we find out that the radio was, in fact, not Johnny's.
Yeah, things
I
are.
I love that you have timestamps, dude.
Things are going to get heated because I actually thought it was at 11 minutes and 21 seconds.
Oh, that's okay. Where were you when you were watching? You might have been 2 hours
oh,
behind
me. Shit. That's funny as fuck.
All right. Let's
yeah,
wrap this
next
up.
Next week we'll do that, yeah.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. It was a very informative. It was a good one.
Very good.
It was a good one.
Thank
good
you,
episode.
Les.
Yeah, very, thanks you for, said very informative, yeah.
Thanks to Les and Erica for coming. All right, everybody. Happy Mother's Day last week.
Yeah, yeah. And next week will be Cobra Kai Day, so get ready for that.
Everybody get on to
yeah, full spoilers.
YouTube,
so
watch Karate
watch
Kid and Cobra yeah. Kai.
And we'll see you.
Because there
week.
Will be spoilers.
Yeah, exactly.
It's been emotional. Goodbye.
When I woke up this morning, things were looking bad. Seemed like total silence was the only friend I had. A bowl of oatmeal tried to stare me down, and one knew it was 12 o'clock before I realized I was having no fun. Ah, but fortunately, I have the key to escape reality. And you may see me tonight with an illegal smile. It don't cost very much, but it lasts a long while. Won't you please tell the man I didn't kill anyone? No, I'm just trying to have me some fun. The last time I checked my bankroll, it was getting thin. Sometimes it seems like the bottom is the only place I've been. I chased a rainbow down a one-way street, dead end. And my friends turned out to be insurance salesmen. Ah, but fortunately, I have the key to escape reality. And you may see me tonight with an illegal smile. It don't cost very much, but it lasts a long while. Won't you please tell the man I didn't kill anyone? No, I'm just trying to have me some fun. Well, I sat down in my closet with all my overalls, trying to get away from all the years inside my walls. I dreamed the police heard everything I thought. What then? Well, I went to court and the judge's name was Hoffman. Ah, but fortunately, I have the key to escape reality. And you may see me tonight with an illegal smile. It don't cost very much, but it lasts a long while. Won't you please tell the man I didn't kill anyone? No, I'm just trying to have me some fun. Well done.